Okay, we picked up at the beginning of the 120th Rev at 189 hours elapsed time. The majority of the pass over the states was spent updating the SO-65s on the flight plan. We had several targets of opportunity for the Hasselblad. Also, we had completed our review of the RCS propellant situation, advised the crew that they were being very frugal in the use of their RCS, and if they wanted to today, they could open it up a bit more and use essentially what they had used in the previous 2 days, or double what they had used in the previous day. At the same time, we started to compute the point at which we'd cut over into our Volkswagen tanks in the RCS system, and gave the crew the updates where they could expect to see their fuel manifold pressure start to decay and they'd have to cut in their secondary tanks. Over the Redstone, we advised the crew that we were going to run a test on the high gain antenna, which is an addition to the flight plan, and we more or less gave them a rough briefing as to what was going to be incorporated in that test. At the same time, we asked the crew how much time they wanted tomorrow afternoon for stowage, actually allowance for them to secure all the gear on board and get ready for reentry prior to going to sleep. The 121st Rev, we started. Everything was pretty squared away, and we are setting up for our SO-65 over the Colorado River, Snyder, Texas, and the Cumberland Plateau, and we continued on the briefing of the crew for the high-gain antenna test. An interesting item we've been tracking all day. If you remember earlier, we reported that the condenser exhaust temperature in fuel cell number 2 is regulating high. Now, for some reason, it appears to be operating properly again. And as such, we changed our management plan for our cryogenics tonight, and we're going to stay essentially powered up at the same power level we have been all day. We made some checklist changes with the crew, starting to update their reentry checklist at 191.59. At this time, we also uplinked some pointing data for the crew so that they could look at Pegasus, the Pegasus satellite. We'd been looking for the last couple of days, particularly today when it appeared we had some time, for tracking objects of opportunity for the crew, actually for two reasons. One, it's a good exercise for the flight dynamics team down in the trench to work out this type of relative motion problem, since it's the same type of problems we have to work out for rendezvous. Secondly, it gives us a good check on the spacecraft GNN system. However, we weren't able to find any objects that we could track with the optics, which we had hoped to do, and as such, we had to stay more or less to the bore site and have the crew look at it as it passed by. We acquired and tracked Pegasus over at Ascension at about 1,000 nautical miles range, and we were quite happy with that. Over Carnarvon, we started the high-gain antenna test and continued that test through the Hawaii Pass. That was in the end, towards the end of the 122nd Rev. 123rd Rev, we passed the crew a landmark update for their landmark tracking task, and they were able to accomplish that landmark tracking. Again, we passed them data for acquisition of the Pegasus satellite. This time it was in around 750 miles, I believe. And the crew acquired Pegasus again at 194.15. We gave them several Hasselblad opportunity targets for photography throughout the rest of the flight plan. And from then on, everything else was pretty normal. We passed, just as we left over there, we passed the crew one final run at Pegasus today, and they ought to be looking essentially down the, I won't say the thrust vector, the velocity vector of Pegasus as it comes towards them, and it should go almost directly over them. We're essentially at a node right now, so they should have a good long pass. It's estimated that from the time, if they could see it at the horizon, about 1,000 miles, it would take about 4 minutes for it to go directly overhead, so they ought to have a pretty good crack at tracking it. And that's basically it.
Okay.
We really can't. The procedure is basically this. Both the crew and ourselves will be monitoring the fuel manifold pressure. And when we see the pressure decay to approximately 170 PSI, see, this is just an estimation where we ought to start looking out for it. Okay? And this is really about 40% remaining in each of the tanks. And this is where we just start looking out for it, and we're getting pretty close to it right now, so we could expect a crossover anytime within, say, the next 24 hours. And this will be on a tank-by-tank basis. So this is more or less just a warning to them and to us to stay on our toes at this point in the game.
Go ahead, Ed.
Will your third look at Pegasus, their third look at Pegasus, be through optics, possibly?
No. No, at this time, the problem is the tracking rates are still very high. Again, we're going to be using the Coas and Borsite. Like I say, we've been trying to find something more in the plane of our orbit, and everything we've looked at today, too, we looked at part of a Titan III, and we looked at, I think it was it Ogo or Oso? We had several of them, but they're all 90 degrees to us.
Idea at what angles they'll cross planes at this next...
It's just about right angles again. All of them today, all today long, it's been just about 90 degrees.
What time is that Pegasus pass?
I don't know. I didn't record it in my log. It's in... Here it is, right here. It's 197.1300. Is one, it's 1,100 miles on the horizon, and 197.1732 is one it should pass overhead at about 100 miles.
Where did they see it the second time? You said the range was 750 nautical miles, the second acquisition.
That's roughly what it was.
Where were they when they, you said the first?
That was over Ascension Island again.
Both over Ascension?
Yes.
Right.
In fact, all of these will be in the vicinity of Ascension or South America.
And the time of sighting on the first instance?
They were over Ascension there also.
Oh, the time.
Oh, quiet. Time. Stand by. I believe it was 192.4309.
Distances.
I think they described it the first time. They didn't describe it the second time, but the first time it was as two bright lights or blinking lights, I think they said. The transcript was not clear at that point, there to ground, but it sounded like just almost like a star.
Well, does this COAS site...
COAS is one power.
One power.
Yes,
no,
it's unity.
Go ahead, Tom.
Gene, what about the weather? Have you made a decision on the landing site?
No, at the present time, that's why we brought the weatherman along. At the present time, it looks quite reasonable in the prime landing area, but I'm sure he can... discuss that in more detail. We're expecting that we'll start looking at it very closely now, somewhere early tomorrow morning.
Can we go into it now?
Yeah.
Sure. Okay, do you want to know what our forecast is and what the reasons behind this forecast are? Is this what you're looking for?
It looks good for prime zone, and what about the conflicting reports today, et cetera, et cetera?
All right. Right now and all day today, our forecast for the end of mission at 151-1 has been for acceptable weather conditions. We're forecasting just partly cloudy skies and northwesterly winds ranging between 15 and 20 knots with 4 to 5 foot seas and 10 foot northwesterly swell. Now, I know that earlier today there was a conflicting report that came from the Guadalcanal, and we were a little bit concerned about this as to why, you know, it should have happened, because we've been coordinating these forecasts and so forth and had been in agreement all along. But what had happened was that yesterday our forecast had called for the weather in the West Atlantic to be good, to be better on Wednesday than it would be on Thursday. And the shipboard aerologist was using this forecast when he was speaking to the press today. And it just so happened that virtually as soon as he had finished talking to the press, that the new forecast came in. And so he was putting out the forecast that we had all agreed upon, but it was a day late, is what it amounted to. So he is in agreement now that the weather, agreement with us, that the weather will be acceptable.
Could you please, did you say 4 to 5 foot seas and 10 foot swells?
Yes.
What's the difference, please?
Well, the swell is a residual wave that is left over from the storm that is in this area right now. A swell is a result of a long duration wind over a long distance. And the sea is caused, it's a locally wind generated wave. Now, once in a while, this can be pretty rough if you get the two coinciding. There will be some. Actually, our winds are expected to be continuing out of the northwest, but probably a little bit more westerly than what they have been running. So there may be a little, they'd be crossing each other just slightly.
Rudy? Let's wait for the mic.
So what you're saying is that the weather's improving right now and should continue to improve right through Thursday?
The weather has really not been improving very much. As a matter of fact, if you look at the observations that we're getting from the ships out there, you would say that they have been, well, any improvement has been nil. But I think that the encouraging sign to us is the beginning of the rain out here, right here at Houston. I think that this is the beginning of a formation of a wave down in this area, a trough of low pressure that will be moving eastward quite rapidly, probably about 30 to 35 knots. So that on Thursday, this will be lying off the Atlantic coast and will weaken the pressure gradient that has now given us the strong winds in the Guadalcanal area. I don't think that we're going to see any improvement, though, in their weather observations until sometime tomorrow.
Nelson? Gene, what's your prime option in case that weather does deteriorate?
Go further actually got three options right now. You've got the 151.1. You can move it downrange if that appears to be more satisfactory, or you can pick a 152.1 area. And at the present time, the carrier is going to be down in the area of 137.1, which is about midway between these three options. It's more or less a triangular shape they've got.
What do you forecast the interval between the swells will be on Thursday?
10 to 12 seconds.
10 to 12.
Mm-hmm. In that area today, they've been reporting about 15-foot swells, about 12 to 14 second periods. This will be decreasing somewhat by Thursday.
Gene, 137-1 is where the spacecraft would splash down if you were to bring tomorrow. It back in tomorrow morning. Is there any possibility that you might do that?
There's always a possibility, but based on the weather we've seen right now, I don't think that is a reasonable possibility from a weather standpoint.
When would you pass the point of no return, so to speak, for a re-entry tomorrow?
John, what's the retro time for 137-1?
Tomorrow?
That's one piece of information we didn't bring.
Yeah.
Well, have you got the rough block time?
I meant going back beyond that to when they'd start having to stow their gear and doing all that other stuff prior to even burning retrofire.
Well, I think they're pretty much stowing as they go along right now. They're trying to keep a pretty clean cockpit. I'd say it'd be roughly 3 to 4 hours prior to that deorbit time that you'd have to make up your mind.
So that your option is open really until like breakfast time tomorrow morning.
That's right. We make a daily go-no-go for each one of these areas, same as we've done since the beginning of the mission.
Gene, if you land where you want to go on Thursday morning, how much does the carrier have to do to start getting there, and how far does it have to go, and when does it have to start moving?
I don't know what the exact mileage is. Somewhere around 10 o'clock tomorrow morning, I was just talking to the recovery people, and John, I'm sure, is more familiar with this. We have to make up our mind whether we're going to the presently planned recovery area or to take that area downrange or start moving towards 152. So it's going to be tomorrow morning sometime.
The go-no-go, the time that we get ready tomorrow morning, we have to get to go-no-go at about 6 to 6:30. And after that, then after the go-no-go is made, of course, the retrofire for 137-1 is around 9 o'clock tomorrow morning, 9:20, somewhere like that. So what we make the go-no-go in plenty of time, we have to have essentially 2.5 hours from the time we decide that we're going to come in, when we are planning on it. Between the time we make the go-no-go, get the data up in.
Suppose you wait till Thursday, the nominal time.
Okay.
And is the carrier that far away from the aiming point at this point on the Thursday splashdown, so that I'll have to start moving, let's say, tomorrow morning to get there?
I believe that's basically correct. Now, I'm sure there's a few hours pad either direction, but they deliberately sighted it in a position today, in addition to watching out for the weather, such that it could move back into the prime area, which is 151, the uprange portion, or slide that downrange, or be in a position to be very near to the 152 area. So,
what are we talking about, a couple of 100 miles?
I don't know what the range is at that time. Maybe not sure it is.
I can give you the target points. Yeah. I can see it better when I get down here. Okay, I can give you, I know the target points for the 151-1. You can see them, and I'll be able to put on the 152-1s when I get down to my part of it. I can. I don't know that target point, but I can spot it about.
Do you want to sketch this out now?
Yeah, you want to start into that?
Yeah. It's the first landing area in the 151st revolution, I think. Isn't that right, John?
That's affirmative. Let me come down here and see if I can get this squared away.
By the way,
that's been constant since the Gemini program, believe it or not.
What I'll do here is I'll talk about the mission, and we can talk about 137-1 tomorrow, which I don't think we will. Right here, let me, by the way, I will leave this map over here, and the ground track won't change. At time to fire, we'll shoot for this target. And that happens to be, and I'll read it off if you want it. That happens to be 67 degrees west and 30 degrees and 39 minutes north. And that's 151-1 target point. 30 degrees, 39 minutes north. And that's this. Okay?
John, before you do that, isn't that as far north as they've ever come for a splashdown on that line?
That's pretty far north. Let me see, I think Apollo 7 came in about 28 north, good round numbers.
Could that be seen somewhere on the reentry point with the heat of friction?
Yes, blackout begins. You'll be able to see on the East Coast.
Whereabouts?
Sort of around here. We'll be beginning blackout.
How about right on the coast?
Where, like Charleston?
Is that what that is, Charleston?
Yes, sir. That's
Charleston, South Carolina?
Charleston,
could you see it there?
It'll come right over the top of Charleston.
Could you see it there?
It will be not at a blackout yet, but I would imagine you could see. Let me see if it's all right now. It should be about right to see it.
In daylight?
It's going to be cloudy anyway.
This will be. Well, we've been able. I mean, the reason I say that is because you can see the reflected sun this way. This, what time is it? This will be 9 o'clock, right?
After 10 o'clock.
Oh, that's right. Retrofire is about 9 o'clock here in Houston. So that you're right. That's 10 o'clock. And it'll be another 20 minutes, be about 10:20 there. So you won't be able to see it.
Won't it be lit up at all from the heat of friction? I don't think discernibly.
I don't think you could see it when you're thinking about 10 o'clock in the daytime. That was my mistake. Say again? I wouldn't. I would hazard a guess. The 400K feet is right over Fort Worth.
Pardon me?
That's 67 miles. That's 400K over Fort Worth.
Now, how far downrange, John? How far downrange might you be able to move that to move the ship on 151-1?
Gene said you had options of moving the splash point downrange.
Well, look,
going
if we,
to 152.
If, let's talk it this way. If we have a forecast tomorrow that definitely looks bad at this point, okay, we will at that time make a decision whether to move it this way, out of it, which I think, if I'm not mistaken, the weather is further eastwardly, isn't it, the bad weather?
No, we'd want to move it eastward.
Okay, so we could move it this way, or we could move it back this way.
The likelihood is to move it eastwardly.
By his time.
That's the dash 3, is it?
No, that would just be... Look, let me get this straight. The one areas are in the Atlantic. Okay. I would assume what we'd do, since the weather is in the northerly section of the thing, we would probably come in 162-1, which is in the southerly. More southerly, and I don't think we got any problem down there. We can come into that easy enough.
Have you got the coordinates for
one? Yes, it's 166nd rev only in one area. That's what that means.
152nd.
John, can you give us some nominal times for this sequence of events? I'm looking
at
nominal
I got those.
Here. Good.
Well, wait just a second. I've got a pending question about the coordinates.
Right.
Oh, 152, yeah, roger. 68 degrees west and 23 degrees north.
20,
yes, sir.
And you said you could mark one.
You said you could mark 137 on the map there.
If yes, I probably couldn't guess at it. You have the coordinates?
Yeah. It looks like about 27, 2, and 68.
68, you say? I think that's
68
about right.
And 27, 2.
68. You see, that's 25, right? Just about here. Okay. That's for tomorrow now.
Mark that 137, would you say?
Okay.
Yeah. And 152 is south of that, about 4 degrees, huh?
Right, that's right. Let me just go through that. Just check it. 68 and 23. And this is 20. Okay. And that ground track, of course, will be passing this way.
While he's marking them, what's the weather forecast for the 152-1 area?
152-1 looks like it'll be real good. That's just trade wind weather down there. They'll have easterly winds about 10 knots.
Okay.
Perhaps scattered showers, but no problems.
Can I ask, I guess, the weatherman a little point of strategy? You, Gene said you've got the Guadalcanal positioned at about 137.1 now, and this looks as though you can make a decision tomorrow. You can either send her going directly north or about the same distance directly south. In other words, about the same travel time to either one of the splashdown areas on Thursday. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's what
I think that's what the thought I was conveying earlier.
That's right.
Yeah, I think the just to clarify a point, the present 152.1 as it's sighted, the
about 240 miles, 260 miles.
260?
Mm-hmm, from here to here.
Yeah, I was talking to the recovery people just before I came over, and the carrier could not make the present 152-1, although they could probably have helos down there, and this is one of the items that they are talking with the recovery force people now. So there may be some slight readjustment in 152-1 if they decided that's where they wanted to go. I don't have the clue. It'd be back towards the area. It'd be closer to 137-1. I mean, looks like it'd be back up range.
I got those for the nominal SPS burn. Yeah. And I'll leave these over here, too, in GMT and total elapsed time.
Yeah, why don't you just hang it up? Might be easier for them to read that way rather than try to copy it all down.
I can.
Okay, fine, there. Fine.
I'll read them. The ignition time is 238 hours, 52 minutes. Okay, and that's over Hawaii. About mid-pass. The 400 K feed time, I've just spotted that. That's 239.09. 239.09. I can read you the seconds if you want me to. Okay, I'll start all over again. The ignition time is 238 hours, 52 minutes, and 1 second. The 400 K-foot time is 239 hours, 9 minutes, and 7 seconds.
Where is that located?
That's right here. Okay, begin blackout is 239 hours, 11 minutes, and 47 seconds.
Where would that be, John?
It would be over here somewhere.
What's that?
Around Jackson.
Jackson, Mississippi?
Mm-hmm.
Is that the 250,000?
Let me see.
Plus that. Shortly after 05G.
It's shortly after 05G. That's right. I was trying to get the number straight. It's about 300,000 feet. Okay.
Then you keep on.
Okay, in blackout is 239 hours, 14 minutes, and 58 seconds.
About where would that
be? It's real hard for me to say. It's going to be right along here, like I said. It's going to be in this, out in the ocean, right? It's almost on top of the zero lift because he is falling straight down. Right. It's almost on top of the zero lift because he is falling straight down. You're about 100,000 feet then when that happens.
Okay.
When you break out of blackout. And drogue time is 239 hours, 19 minutes and 15 seconds. And main time is 239 hours, 20 minutes, and 3 seconds. And I predicted landing is 239 hours, 24 minutes, and 38 seconds.
Do you have time for 0.5G and for max G?
Yes, I got a point for 05G. 239 hours, 11 minutes, and 22 seconds. Max G is going to be about the end of blackout. Almost. If he flies a GNN, he'll pull about 3.2 Gs.
Where's the exact splash point? Is that still
195 miles southwest of Bermuda?
This is it right here, and I can give you that real quick. It's about, looks like to me it's about 130 miles, 140 miles.
140?
Yeah.
Southwest of Bermuda?
Yes, sir. Nautical miles, right. That's an estimate. I probably could scale it off some way. That's a pretty good estimate. It's a little over 2 degrees.
What time would be the retro if you do a 152-1?
The retro fire for 152-1?
Right.
You could add about an hour and 20 minutes to what I just gave you.
Is there any way on Thursday morning after it's all over, we go through this every time, of trying to find out where the splash point was in relation to your target point and in relation to the carrier. In other words, somebody on the carrier always says it's about 5,000 yards away, and somebody else says it's...
computer says miles off.
Yeah.
Let me go through the question again.
I think there's several things. We can tell you what the target point is. We'll tell you what the target point is we're shooting for prior to reentry. We can tell you where the spacecraft computer thinks it reentered at. Okay? We can let you know where our ground radar thinks it entered at, and the carrier people can tell you where they think it landed.
But you were,
and I don't really know how you can beat down which one of those.
Go ahead, Nelson.
Could we wait for Mike, please? We're trying to transcribe this, and we haven't had time to get
Go ahead, Nelson.
Gene, did I understand you to say that you could not get the carrier to 152-1 even if you made a 152-1 decision tomorrow morning?
That's how you define 152-1. As it is presently defined, it's going to be close but not quite there. Now, that may change.
Assuming that you decided on 152-1 24 hours ahead of splash, you could not get it there in time.
No, what I'm saying is we could move 152-1 back up range and still call it 152-1. At the present spot where 152-1 is, the carrier won't be on the OSP. Now, that's based on a very brief discussion with the recovery people about 10 minutes before I came over here. So I may be very wrong about that. But it's my belief that the carrier won't be quite there, but they will,
here,
will have helos there if that's where we decide to go, at that target point, which is presently selected.
Probably another way of saying it, instead of having 68 degrees west and 23 north, we can make it 24 north, okay, and some other longitude. Just retarget it, but still call it 152-1.
That's right.
The nomenclature 152-1, again, is it's on a 152nd rev as it comes to the one area. This is the one area is here.
I'm aware of that. I was just trying to follow up with the
and the four areas are here. That's all it says. And if we've missed that, we could go to 154-4.
Okay. Gene, go ahead.
Harking back to Apollo 7, I seem to recall that maybe the carrier thought it was on target and was way off, and Chris Kraft thought the spacecraft was on target, and maybe it was, but the carrier said it wasn't. Out of all of these figures you were giving us that you could give us, what would be the most accurate one in telling us whether you landed on target or not?
Whether, in fact,
you hit the ocean at the latitude and longitude that you said you were going to hit the ocean at, or you wanted to.
Well, I think it'd all probably come out quite equal if you didn't have winds and parachute drift. You're in the chutes for a relatively long period of time, and you can drift a heck of a ways in that period of time. John, I don't know what would you believe?
Well, I think that this discussion of the Apollo 7 reentry after it was over with, that they had a squall come in the area about the time that right after retrofire, and they decided at that time they were really socked in, and they actually made a evasive maneuver to get off the target point because they could not see. And all that discussion about where they were, et cetera, was they on. That's a mighty big piece of equipment to be moving around, and they admittedly said that they got off the target point. Now, that was after the smoke cleared. I guess it was a couple days later that I heard that.
But, well, I think the whole question is, I think that they're all extremely close, and you're talking about an order of thousands of feet. And just to really stick my neck out, there's some of the ground-based sites we've got that we don't, let's put it this way, that's about as close as we know where some of our tracking sites
that's
are.
That's probably true.
So it's all quite relative as to which one is correct. It's very difficult.
With the Apollo GNN system, and as long as it works, it did it well as it did in 7 and 8, when we get data around here that says that it's doing very well before we go into blackout, you can almost assuredly bet that it's going to be right there. And I don't care where the carrier is.
Go ahead. In the event, unlikely, I hope, that you have to go to 152-1 or 137-1, Would it then be reasonable to assume that, or do you know, you'd bring the astronauts in either to the Cape or to maybe to Puerto Rico or something like that? In other words, you'd scrub Norfolk as a landing zone.
Gee, I'm not that familiar with the recovery plans. I'm sure that for each one of these landing areas, actually recovery is nailed down where they'd debark the crew, and I do not have that information.
You get much south of 151-1, then there's no 6 or 1.5 dozen the other between going to Cape and Norfolk, so it would be reasonable we might go someplace else.
It's possible, but I'd suggest that we get that answer directly from recovery.
What's this, Gene, where the crew goes?
Where the crew goes.
Probably tomorrow you could probably get Slate to come over and talk, just because we still got another couple of days.
When you're playing around with the kinds of weather conditions you are predicting, will the crew's desires as to what kind of weather conditions they'd like to land in have anything to do with the decision that's been made? I noticed in the transcript today they were perhaps in jest saying, you know, we'd like a nice calm piece of water.
We'll always put them down in a nice calm piece of water that's adequate. See, there's many other things that come in there. It's a function of degree of calmness versus how fast can you get to them, okay, versus how good tracking coverage you've got, versus capability to provide coverage with both fixed wing and rotor aircraft, and you name it. So there's I'd say about a dozen parameters that come into that decision in addition to the weather decision.
Well, I think what I'm asking is if you can provide adequate coverage in 152, in a RESA designated 152-1, simply to have 4 foot seas instead of
yes, we would.
You would, okay.
We would, but that's a function of the quality of coverage. And if you take a look in the mission roll, there's several parameters that get involved in the selection of a specific landing area.
And recovery capability are the two most pertinent.
That's right. Those are the first two.
Then we start backing down. We have other things that go into that.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.